In the coming week, Israeli-Palestinian clashes raise fears of a bigger conflict. Chile begins an historic election year, and Washington tries to improve its cyber defenses after a fuel pipeline hack. It's May 13th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, as we sat down for this podcast, there is an escalating battle going on between Israeli forces and the Palestinian group Hamas based in Gaza. Many have said these are the most severe clashes, at least since 2014, if not earlier, involving the firing of hundreds of rockets on Israel from Hamas forces, including at Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and Israeli retaliations with extremely deadly airstrikes on Gaza positions, including civilian deaths being reported there and in Israel, it should be noted. This has stirred mounting international concern. You've had statements come out from the UN Security Council. U.S. is ratcheting up its contacts with Israel. Jim, bring us up to speed on what's happening there.
Well, Bob, the first thing to admit is that it's a very fluid situation. The facts on the ground could change significantly by the time the podcast airs, especially given the potential for an Israeli invasion of Gaza itself. As we're sitting down to do the podcast, there are news reports saying that Israeli forces are gathering on the border of Gaza. And obviously, this would not be the first time Israel has gone into Gaza. It did so most recently in 2014. But as we look at the current situation, there are two aspects that stand out. One is familiar and one is not. The familiar one, sadly, is Gaza rocket attacks on Israeli cities and settlements and Israeli retaliation. We've seen that before. The unfamiliar one, and the one that's getting a bit less attention in much of the coverage, is the spread of sectarian violence in Israel proper. Now, while we think of Israel as a Jewish state, 20% of its population is Arab. Now, relations between Jews and Arabs in Israel have been relatively peaceful until the last few days, where again, we have seen a significant surge in violence. We've seen Jewish mobs ransacked Arab businesses near Tel Aviv. Arab citizens in the city of Lod have rioted and torched synagogues. Suddenly, we're hearing in the Israeli press the ominous word civil war. And I'll note that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is running a caretaker government at the current time, has called on both communities to de-escalate the violence. Now, the proximate cause of the surge in violence we're seeing were clashes that took place over the weekend at Haram al-Sharif, al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, an area that is sacred to both Muslims and Jews. We saw Israeli security forces engaged in battles with Palestinians at Aqsa Mosque, and that has since sort of spilled over. If people want to learn more about the specific background of those clashes, I sat down with our colleague Stephen Cook, who's an expert in Middle East politics, to walk through that on our sister podcast, The President's Inbox. What's significant right now is that tensions are high, and we have a couple of anniversaries coming up that could further fuel the violence. Tomorrow, May 14th, is the anniversary of Israel gaining its independence in 1948, and Saturday is Nakba, or Catastrophe Day. That's the day that Palestinians mark the more than 700,000 Palestinians who fled Israel proper as a result of Israel's victory in the 1948 war. And so there is a lot of combustible timber that could make it very hard to de-escalate anytime soon.
Jim, I'm particularly struck by the way you staked it out with the not surprising or sort of familiar terrain that we've seen, regrettably, in this battle and the new territory, which is the mentioning of a civil war, which is something, in my recollection, that you do not hear that often, despite the many, many tensions and the fact that Jewish and Arab communities live very close to each other in some places. That seems to be the area that's getting a little bit more attention now, although the Hamas-Israeli military clash is dominating. But are you seeing any efforts, aside from the Netanyahu appeal, to try to calm that? Because as you noted, Netanyahu is in a caretaker role. Palestinians themselves have delayed their own elections. There seems to be this political vacuum happening at a particularly bad time. And the emergence of someone with some leverage and some gravitas into the situation seems to be sort of lacking right now.
What becomes clear as you look at the various calls for de-escalation is there's disagreement over who should de-escalate first, because again, there's disagreement over who is at fault for the current set of tensions. When you look at the tensions that we're familiar with, watching Hamas attack Israel, Israel respond, that reopens a lot of standing divisions in the international community. And I will note that the Biden administration has been forthright in our arguing that Israel has a right to defend itself. It's been a long-standing U.S. policy. And I will note that the United States refused to go along with an effort at the U.N. Security Council to issue a statement that would have called for a ceasefire in the hostilities. Ceasefire, by the way, that Israel has rejected, again, on the grounds that Israel has the right under international law to respond to attacks coming from Hamas. Now, that obviously creates tensions between the Biden administration and a variety of its allies who are on the other side of that dispute. Now, we'll see if there's going to be a way in the coming days to broker some language that is acceptable to all the parties. That may be very hard to do, and whether it can be done will depend upon the choices that both Hamas and particularly the Israelis make. If the Israelis go into Gaza, that greatly escalates the situation. In past encounters, go back to the 2014 invasion or 2006, these were protracted, very difficult incursions that led to prolonged negotiations to try to sort of put things back together.
And I would just add, it would be interesting to watch the degree to which Arab countries are seized of the urgency of the situation and might press to try to intervene in some fashion. Much has been made of the brokering of the Abraham Accords by the Trump administration with some Gulf Arab states, Morocco, Sudan, and so forth. But at the end of the day, if we see countries like Saudi Arabia or Egypt or others get involved, it will be interesting to watch the extent to which they do want to get involved. There have been some what seem to be fairly pro forma responses of concern, but nothing else beyond that at this point.
You're quite right, Bob, that Arab capitals have issued statements calling for de-escalation, but those have not been matched by any substantive action to put pressure on Israel. I think for now, talk about extending or expanding the Abraham Accords to include other countries, most notably Saudi Arabia, that's all on hold. And I think the Arab capitals are hoping that the situation can be contained. Now, if Israel goes into Gaza, that sort of scrambles the situation and will put more pressure on some of these capitals to take some steps to signal their affiliation or affinity for Palestinians. So again, this is where it is quite complicated, but keep in mind, many Arab capitals, most notably Cairo, but also Abu Dhabi, and I would imagine Riyadh as well, have no great affection for Hamas. They don't mind seeing Hamas being taken down a peg or two. And again, this gets you into the complicated nature of inter-Arab politics.
And meantime, on the U.S. side of this, as you mentioned, it's posing another early challenge for the still young Biden administration, which hasn't really kind of put together its Middle Eastern team, especially vis-a-vis Israel.
Well, you're right there, Bob. And I think the Biden administration came into office seeking to deprioritize the Middle East broadly, but also the issue of Israeli-Palestinian peace. I think that was partly driven by their calculation that the United States needs to focus its time and energy on what's happening in Asia, particularly with the rise of China, and also a hard-headed political calculation that the situation in Israel and Palestine wasn't ripe for making any progress in negotiating a peace deal. And that's somewhat of a break from prior administrations, because most administrations come in and very early on make it a priority to try to negotiate a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I will note the Biden administration did not appoint a special envoy to deal with Middle East peace, unlike most prior administrations. The Biden administration still has not nominated an ambassador to Israel. And indeed, this portfolio is being handled in the State Department by a deputy assistant secretary of state. Now, for people who aren't familiar with the hierarchy in the State Department, that's what we might call a mid-level position. And this deputy assistant secretary of state, Hadi Amer, has been dispatched to Israel to meet with leaders on both sides to see if he can find a way of bringing the two sides together and de-escalating. But that's quite clearly different than sending, let's say, your secretary of state or the vice president, as one might imagine having happened in past crises. And likewise, I think this issue creates real challenges for President Biden at home. It's likely to expose divisions within the Democratic Party over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Now, I'll note you'll get agreement pretty much across the board here in the United States about Israel's right to respond to attacks coming from Hamas in Gaza. But beyond that, when you start talking about Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and potentially now within Israel itself, you get real divisions within the Democratic Party. We saw that play out during the primary campaign for the Democratic nomination, where candidate Bernie Sanders, among others, proposed withholding U.S. aid to Israel unless Israel changed its treatment of Palestinians.
And once again, the Middle East is not a place to be left behind lightly by any U.S. administration coming in.
Yes, sadly, it seems that for administrations, the fact that you want to turn your back on the Middle East doesn't mean the Middle East will turn its back on you. But Bob, let's turn our attention away from the Middle East and look at South America. Specifically, I want to talk about upcoming elections in Chile. This weekend, Chileans are going to be voting for members of the body that will draw up a new constitution for the country. Because of the threats posed by COVID-19, this election to select delegates for a constitutional convention has already been postponed several times. Bob, can you tell us how do we get here and where are the Chileans going?
Jim, I'd be happy to. First of all, we should turn our clock back to the fall of 2019, where you had somewhat unprecedented protests in Chile erupting, with the trigger being a hike in metro fares, relatively small hike. But it spilled over into mass protests, a pretty sharp police clampdown. There were, at one point, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in the streets, and it escalated into calls for changes well beyond metro fares and dealing with broader concerns about inequality in Chile. And this deals with wages and healthcare and education and pensions and so forth. And it got so big that the protesters basically seized on the fact that the only way to get their demands met was to revisit the Chilean constitution, which had not been changed since the days of the dictator Augusto Pinochet. So that dates to about 1980. And so the government agreed. They held a referendum. And this was an idea that was initially pushed by people more on the left in Chile. There was a landslide vote in favor of drawing up a new constitution. 78% of the people voted for that. Really seen as a moment to kind of redefine what the Chilean state is, what its role should be in paying for healthcare, in paying for education, in helping to make sure the wages are fair. And this is a country that seemed a bit incongruous to outsiders who are used to saying, hey, Chile is the star of South America. It's got a strong GDP. It's continues to grow. Look at its private sector model. But in fact, that model was not addressing the needs of almost half the population. There were statistics that show Chile is one of the most unequal countries in the OECD group of developed countries. And something like half of Chileans earn less than $500 a month. So that all goes to say, Jim, that we've come to this moment after delays, partly caused by COVID and other concerns, and people will be able to pick members of a constitutional convention who will start the process of drawing up the constitution. They cannot be office holders. It has to be equal gender, equal number of male and female. And it is due to be drawn up and voted on by 2022. So it's going to set the process going in earnest. This particular vote coincides with a slew of local elections, provincial, mayoral, governor level, and so forth. Later in the year, there'll be national elections. It's what they're calling a mega vote in Chile kicking off. We should also note that COVID hasn't vanished by any means. In fact, there had a bit of a nasty spike early this spring after the country had thought it was out of the woods following an early round of vaccinations. Now it seems to be possibly ebbing a little bit in time for this vote, but it's certainly something that's continuing to cast a cloud over the country. And also COVID, as it has worldwide, Jim, I should note, has pointed out inequalities in terms of access to healthcare, in terms of access to economic safety net when things like businesses get locked down and so forth.
Bob, can we go back to the issue of selecting delegates to this constitutional convention? Because I'm still not sure how this is scheduled to play out. So you have an election, you pick delegates, that part I get. But then people have to sit down and craft a document. How do we know that the group that comes together will be able to put together a document on any particular timeline? I say that because I just finished reading a book entitled The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. In this case, the United States Constitution. And when they came together, they hoped to knock it out in a couple of weeks. They ended up spending the entire summer in Philadelphia. This is pre-air conditioning, pretty hot, trying to do it. And of course, they did it in relative secrecy. Now we live in a world in which everything can go global in a heartbeat with one tweet. So how do the Chileans know they're going to be able to come up with a document that works under which they can run subsequent elections, given uncertainty about even who's going to be writing the document?
It's a really good question, Jim. I mean, even in the best of times, meaning, you know, no pandemic and no other stresses going on worldwide, as you indicate, it's a tough business. It's a messy business for democracies to draw up a constitution. I mean, the previous one was done with no public input. It did end up getting some recognition and even acclaim from sectors of the public that liked its sort of free market emphasis. But I think what the hope is this time, and again, I think we're going to see a really delicate, fraught period. You're supposed to have, first of all, a debate for about 9 9 months about key aspects of the Constitution. There's an option to extend for another 3, and then it's supposed to be put to public for ratification next year. Now, I'm not sure if there's any other ways they can kick the can down the road and extend it further. We'll have to see how messy this process becomes, Jim. But I think the hope is, with such an overwhelming desire for a new Constitution, and because of the overriding reasons, because of an acknowledgement, I think, potentially with a critical mass of Chileans, that they do not have adequate broad health care, they do not have properly set up pension system or an ability to set up that, the ability to raise wages, that they can hammer out some basic compromises that will allow the country to move from where it has been since 1980 in terms of its ability to have flexibility in its decision making. And so if they can do that, the thinking is that it's time for a new Chile. But Chile's got divisions like many other countries are seeing, including many democracies, Jim, in terms of real sharp left-right divides. And so part of the intrigue that this weekend holds is going to be these other elections. Like, are you going to see this wave of progressives voted in, for example, at all different levels? Or is there going to be divides on display across the board like we've seen in Peru as well? So it's a really good question, Jim. And it's hard to see how they're going to come out at the end of this and how we're going to be here talking in 2022 about Chile's new constitution. But they got to start somewhere. And so here we go.
And so remind me, Bob, when do the Chileans hope to bring this constitution before the people?
Well, if you see this going a full 12 months, say the 9 months and an extended 3, we could be back here a year from now, poised to talk about a big constitution vote in Chile. So mid-spring of 2022.
Okay.
So hold on, and we'll keep updating you throughout the year as we get closer to this process.
I guess in this situation, the question is whether the Chileans want to get a constitution written quickly, which might give more time for people to read it, argue over it, and potentially divide over it, or to have it drag on until just before the vote's scheduled.
It's a really good point, Jim. It's really new territory. And the fact that the people taking part in this convention will not be sitting politicians gives this different air, let's say. And maybe you have more practical people, or maybe you have more idealistic people. It's going to be very interesting to see what the Chileans come up with.
Very fascinated by the process. Looking forward to seeing what happens.
Well, Jim, I want to talk about something else happening closer to home here. As I drove this morning my daughter to her school, there were cars lined up outside of gas stations. And it was a scene I hadn't seen too often, although my earliest memory of such was the early 70s oil embargo days. I'm not saying we're there, but we're in a space now in this country where there's a great deal of concern caused by a hack, more specifically the hack of the Colonial Pipeline. This occurred late last week. It shut down operations in a number of mid-Atlantic and southeastern U.S. states. The country is announcing it's going to resume operations, just announced just last night. We'll see whether oil is flowing freely through these pipelines by this weekend, but already the scare has been put out and it's sort of fed on itself, creating these lines, and a great deal of concern about hacking and the vulnerability of the U.S. infrastructure. But Jim, I wanted to go to you. What do we know about this hack and future threats it might pose?
We know a fair amount, Bob, but I don't think we know everything we want to know. But let's begin with a bit of good news, which is that Colonial Pipeline, which was the company that was hacked, has been able to resume operations. Gasoline is beginning to flow again. They hope to have the system back at full capacity sometime over this coming weekend. And I will note that the lines that you've experienced, which do give those old Americans, certainly like myself, flashback to the early 1970s of waiting in long lines to get gas for automobiles, that actually there's not a gas shortage. What is simply happening is that people, because they're concerned about the potential of gas running out, are getting gas refilled more rapidly than they normally would have. That the actual supply of gas at the current stage is certainly fine. But again, the bigger issue here is the vulnerability of the United States, which has become incredibly reliant on computer systems to attacks. Now, this was a ransomware attack on a private corporation, again, Colonial Pipeline, conducted by a criminal group known as DarkSide, as you mentioned. This was a ransomware attack under which DarkSide, somehow we don't know yet, was able to get into the Colonial Pipeline computer system and essentially lock that system up so that people at Colonial Pipeline couldn't access their own systems. And this is, again, a situation we've seen it done to a lot of smaller towns in cities around America, where the criminals then say, pony up some money if you want to get access back to your system. And of course, the fact that DarkSide launched this attack and that DarkSide seems to be located somewhere in Eastern Europe, potentially in Russia, led to a lot of speculation that perhaps this was somehow a stalking horse for the Russian government. And this is where the attack becomes even more interesting. DarkSide apparently has its own webpage because it had posted a statement saying that DarkSide doesn't participate in geopolitics and that their motives were purely financial, not, let me quote them here, creating problems for society. And that, in fact, DarkSide has an ethics code saying it won't attack places such as hospitals, educational institutions, and the government sector. So we'll see whether that's in fact true. I think there's going to be a big postmortem on this attack in the days and weeks to come. But it again really raises two issues of concern. One, the vulnerability of American computer systems. Number two, the concern that if we ever were to get into a crisis, a real geopolitical crisis with a major power, that it wouldn't necessarily play out the way crises played out in the past, showdowns between the United States and the Soviet Union, the United States and communist China, or even the United States and Iran or North Korea, that because we're so reliant on computer systems, that we may have significant vulnerabilities in our so-called critical infrastructure. And again, part of the challenge for the government is that so much of our critical infrastructure is controlled by private corporations. And how do you create a system that both allows private corporations to be efficient, effective, to grow, but also gets them to take the steps they need to make sure they can't get hacked in just this way? It's a real tough problem, Bob.
Yeah, and I think it's also raised concerns about whether the U.S. policymaking community is so partisan at this point, I guess the lawmaking community in particular, that it has stymied the ability to act properly. And now the president can issue executive orders and certain critical infrastructure can be protected. But there's an interesting parallel playing out where you had discussions just yesterday with both Republicans and Democratic lawmakers about U.S. infrastructure. And it was things like broadband and roads and bridges and so forth. But one would think that would be an opportunity to also talk about protecting that infrastructure, and didn't hear a lot of it. There was some testimony last week by a former DHS official from the Trump administration, who was actually ousted in the late days of the Trump administration, who warned about this very thing. Again, it raised concerns about, is there an ability for Congress to do what it has to do at this point to really safeguard not only pipelines, but anything else that could be in the sights of a dark side or other malign actors?
Well, you're certainly right, Bob. And I think this hack has created a political problem, but potentially also an opportunity for the Biden administration. The political problem, obviously, is people look up and all of a sudden there are long lines to get gas at the gas station. There is concerns that this might get worse before it gets better. And again, a lot of the sort of spot shortages you're seeing has been created by panic buying, not by an actual absence of supply. And the administration has gone out and issued a number of executive orders trying to show that they're in charge and they're responding and getting to work. But much of our critical infrastructure lies in the hands of private entities, as I mentioned. How do you get them to do what needs to be done? And of course, a lot of this is very difficult because, as I saw Senator Mark Warner put it on television the other day, you know, companies have to be right each and every time. Criminal enterprises or foreign governments only need to get it right once. You know, you have somebody with an infected thumb drive or somebody clicks on an email that they shouldn't. But I certainly think that the Biden administration has had a pretty tough week between the Colonial Pipeline hack and what's happened in Israel. And politics doesn't stop just because we've had an election. And I will note that many Republicans have seized on what's happened over the last week to try to deflate some of the political momentum that President Biden has picked up. It seems to be a current theme in a lot of conservative websites, sort of talking about how Joe Biden's taking us back to the 1970s with Palestinian attacks, gas lines in an inept Democratic president. Again, this is conservative websites talking. And I think you're going to be seeing a lot more sort of comparisons to Jimmy Carter. Obviously, Republicans hoping to turn the tide in their favor after having, I think, several months of what most people regard as pretty bad press for Republicans.
I hope using the anti-terrorism policies as a guidepost, it's not just the U.S. fighting the last battle or preventing the last type of attack, but actually being more proactive about what's around the corner, because it's just concerning what we don't know or what might be on the horizon in all sorts of places.
You make a critical point, Bob, because there is a lot that we don't know. And there's a real temptation in the midst of a crisis like this to jump to conclusions about what has actually happened, who has done what. Again, I said a lot of the initial press reports indicated that DarkSide is this criminal enterprise, but we don't know whether it has connections to state governments or not. I think that's going to be explored. explored. The Biden administration, in its public statements, has said it has no evidence that DarkSide is linked, for example, to the Russian government. But again, we're still early in all of this, and all of that will have to be explored in the questions of, you know, why this system broke down. But it takes us back to this question of the importance of computer hygiene in having backup systems. And it also reminds us this great concern that in a crisis, if something like this were to happen, what would be the consequences? And it's a big issue. And we have been speaking about it now for more than a dozen years. And we've created all kinds of commissions to do cybersecurity and look at critical infrastructure. And there have been bills passed and executive orders written. But obviously, we still have a lot of work to do.
That's putting it mildly, Jim. Yeah.
Bob, let's pivot and talk about our audience figure of the week. As always, listeners can vote on or tweet us the figure of the week at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected India versus the B.1.617 variant. What can you tell us about the figure the audience has selected, Bob?
Well, Jim, I think the audience has seized on something that, first of all, has not subsided since we last talked about India's crisis. The latest models show the Indian levels of infection and fatalities sort of peaking within the next week or so. And when you talk about India, you're talking about a very large scale here. So the variant is contributing to fatalities at the level of more than 4,000 a day, which is among the highest levels recorded anywhere in the course of this pandemic. The country, as has been reported, is badly in need of oxygen tanks. It's running out of hospital space anywhere. The crematorias are maxed out. And the flow of people around the country is also raising concern because of the virulence of this variant and the spreadability of it, not only within India, but with its neighbors and densely populated countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan. But also Nepal is recording high levels and just reported a lockdown. Sri Lanka has raised a lot of concern about the variant there. And it's been also noted in at least a score of countries, this particular variant, in a score of countries around the world. It's not completely clear the extent to which the current leading vaccines are effective against it. It does seem like there is still some potency there, but getting those vaccines into the hands of Indians is proving to be a lengthy battle, even after the U.S. pledged to send along millions of vaccines and other countries have agreed to help step in all sorts of ways. And in India, we should note, is itself considered to be one of the top suppliers of vaccines. Something like 60% of vaccines globally are supplied by India, and that has taken a blow, not only for Indians, but for some of these regional countries that I mentioned, Jim. So we're in a situation where there's massive COVID fatigue globally. There's a desire among the countries that have had the luck to get vaccines to try to open up, but a real need to double down and to help out India for the reasons that we've cited repeatedly on this podcast, Jim, which is that no country is safe until every country is safe.
Well, you're quite right, Bob. And I think one of the things to emphasize here, and it goes back to our previous conversations today, there's a whole lot that we don't know. I mean, I read a lot and I note that there's been a lot of talk about how the B.1.617 variant may be more contagious. But I don't think that scientists have really nailed that one down. And the fact that you're having a surge in cases in India isn't by itself evidence that this particular variant of the coronavirus is in fact more contagious. And obviously, we don't even know if it is more contagious, how much more contagious it is against whatever the baseline is chosen. That is, you know, again, great uncertainty as to whether the B.1.617 variant is something that will elude current vaccines or which vaccines. And part of the problem is that it takes time to get this kind of certainty. You know, you have to really do some fairly rigorous tests to know whether or not you can have confidence in making predictions about this. And we just don't know. Obviously, I think there's going to be a lot of work being done, but you're quite right. Overall, I mean, the challenge that India faces is immense given its population, given the simple fact that its healthcare system isn't built to handle a crisis like this, and given the many and manifest mistakes that the Modi government and also state governments made in recent months that have really allowed this surge to take place.
Yeah, and it must be said, you know, while I think we've seen countries across the board make mistakes and some are better than others at learning from them and adapting and coping and adjusting, when you have populist governments like the Modi government is, you know, they tend to compound the errors through all sorts of ways, either denying the impact of COVID or going after the messengers, in this case, media or social media, where there's criticism and just not acting fast enough. And your point about the variants is also important because prior to the real spike that occurred, you had the government encouraging encouraging people to turn out for political rallies, for religious rallies. We published a photo essay on our website showing some of them, mass gatherings, no masks or barely any masks being worn, and people gathered in close proximity. And it stands to reason that those possibly became super spreader events. So it's yet another lesson, as we're seeing, in governance. And again, we hope that the world can rally around India, and that India can learn some lessons as well.
We certainly do, Bob. And I'll just note that it does point to the fact that we're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. I know we as human beings like to have certainty. We like to believe things like pandemics come to a nice, neat, crisp end, and we can go back to our pre-pandemic lifestyles. And that simply may not be the case. And that, I think, is troubling for a lot of people. And again, you have the juxtaposition with the virus surging across India, and looking here at the United States, at really good news that the surge has dropped down. A number of states are reporting that they've gone a day or two without noting any deaths, and case rates are down. So there's a lot of progress here. But again, we're still in some sense on uncharted terrain, and we run the very real problem with variants that we could see a spike back here in the United States, which is again why tackling the virus on a global basis is important, and tackling it simply on a state or national basis is always going to be insufficient.
And that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Japan, United States, and France conduct joint military drills. And the Eastern Pacific hurricane season begins.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and stay healthy out there.